Hello, this is Susan Smith Nash, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the strange case of hydraulic fracturing. In essence, I'm going to be talking about the narratives that sort of have come up lately and surrounded the actual discourse of hydraulic fracturing to the point that it's really difficult to understand or get a handle of what's going on with meaning and meaning making. I'm going to talk about how different types of narratives essentially hijack everything that has to do with hydraulic fracturing, and they push them into sort of predetermined templates of meaning. But before we start, I think you probably noticed that the first slide is of a black swan. You may be familiar with the black swan, the phenomenon of unexpected, yet in hindsight, seeable and predictable, massive change that is incredibly disruptive in the sense of an economic disruption. And it can be the kind of thing that's a disruption due to a political event or a catastrophic event like 9/11 or banking crisis 2008. Or it can be in response to disruptive change of technology. 2012, the black swan has landed. So let's look at some narrative responses to hydraulic fracturing. And I just wanted to make a list really quickly to get started. There's the apocalyptic narrative, archetypal narrative, heuristics and biases. Those are flow from Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, or his work, not just the book Thinking Fast and Slow, teleological, which get at who is the puppet master, and they assume that there is a puppet master somewhere, postmodernist, post-Marxist responses to hydraulic fracturing, the gamer mindset, sort of epistemological mindset, and then wanted to also add global coherence, or essentially conspiracy theories and those types of narratives. As a little bit of background, my bachelor's degree is in geology, and my master's was going to be in economics, almost finished a degree in that, a master's, and was working on an MBA also, until I decided to change and look at writing. So I ended up with a master's degree in English and also a PhD in English. My emphasis was in rhetoric and composition and cultural studies, and my dissertation had to do with an analysis of the apocalyptic narrative and how it's used to manipulate people and how it manifests in literary and film as well as cultural texts. So it was pretty interesting. I like to say it's the gift that keeps on giving because apocalyptic narratives never seem to go away. They're always happy to be with us and frame our way of looking at the future and fill us with raw fear at any rate. So I'd like to look at one phenomenon that I see occurring in all of the hydraulic fracturing narratives. We see that this is essentially a game-changing technology, and it's blocked by narratives of resistance. And the narratives of resistance are nothing new. And I would just like to argue and point that the narratives reflect a lot of long-standing attitudes and feelings that Americans have in particular about technology. There's a bimodal view of technology. On the one side, it's very positive. On the other side, it's very fear. It makes one feel filled with fear. There's the sense that it makes you empowered, and then there's the sense that it dooms you to a dehumanized future in which the machines just ultimately prevail and turn on people and rip them to shreds. At any rate, I wanted to point out that there are anxieties about the nature of technological change in our psyche and deeply embedded within the history of American growth and consciousness. And the duality of about the potential of technology is, I would say, a prime characteristic of the American mentality. And so as such, I think you can expect flowerings of anxiety at each step change in technological accomplishment. A few essayists and also literary texts that reflect and illustrate some of those ongoing anxieties are listed here, and I just wanted to point out a few. Elting Morrison has a potentially nihilistic view of technology. He describes the building of the Erie Canal, but ultimately all that sacrifice and all that creation of the waterway was essentially, ultimately, instantly obsolete the minute that the iron horse, the railroad, blazed trails into the West. So Leo Marx, who wrote The Machine in the Garden, talks about this Edenic view of the American West that characterizes the American psyche. And it's something that, with the railroads, is potentially besmirched, even as it allows appreciation of those same gardens in Yosemite and the West, and so celebrated by so many of our main painters. In the 20th century, F. Scott Fitzgerald talked about, of course, the automobile and mixed emotions about that. It's both a transporting vehicle as well as a killer. And the primary premise of Gatsby himself is the idea of a guy who profited from rigged games. And I think, wow, talking about echoes in Wall Street today, we really see a lot of that. I mean, part of it is echoed in Enron and other places, other celebrated companies that turned out to have rigged games. Thomas Pynchon, Crying of Lot 49, metaphors of slow decline. Technology, when it interacts with human beings, accelerates entropy, the loss of energy. Philip K. Dick, anyway, he's written so many short stories and stories and narratives of agency, primarily loss of agency. The machines essentially prevail. They monitor. They are better humans than humans. And so needless to say, they have to exterminate them. So let's look at the apocalyptic narratives. Apocalyptic narratives are all over hydraulic fracturing. They're fear-driven. They talk about end times, the utter destruction of the world or nature. They are passionately espoused by true believers. There is a Messiah who provides truth or safety. And ultimately, there are limbic or reptilian brain responses, and that's the whole sort of efficacy and effectiveness of the apocalyptic narrative. It triggers a fight-flight reaction, which causes people to seek security at all costs. And so they have an extreme craving for security and deliverance. Now, how can you counter the fear? If you have to counter somebody who's using the apocalyptic narrative in conjunction with hydraulic fracturing, you have to offer security. Security, we like to think, comes in the form of truth, which is science. However, we don't really know everything there is about the things that we are trying to be scientific about. So it can ultimately turn on itself, and the scientific method can be apocalyptic in its own way. But that's for another day. That's quite a complex set of arguments that I've put together. And they're a little bit polemical, which is fun, but it would derail the discussion right now. But let's say this, too. In an apocalyptic narrative, followers are willing to follow to the end, and the leader can be delusional. This is a photograph of David Koresh of Ranch Apocalypse fame. And his followers followed him definitely to the very end, and they hung on his every word, even though many of them questioned him. archetypal narratives are a different kind of narrative that are also essentially deterministic in the way that they create meaning or cause certain meanings to arise from the things that they are being used for. So the reason I bring these up is that once a certain archetypal narrative is invoked, then it's pretty hard to keep your mind from following that really, really comfortable narrative to its end and starting to associate that particular archetype with a phenomenon or a person or a thing or a place. If you would like a review of archetypal narratives, I would recommend Jung, of course, for archetypes. Neumann, who described the great mother, the creative unconscious, archetypes essentially of the feminine, he liked to emphasize those. Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces is really good in essentially helping political types, strategists, make their candidate fit into the comfortable narrative of hero. He also talks about anti-heroes, which I find to be somewhat more interesting. Other archetypes that you would recognize that have been described by Jung and also Campbell are the child, the trickster, and of course, I think the trickster is probably the number one archetypal narrative, the character that's invoked in hydraulic fracturing. That and the warrior, who tends to be the person who's fighting hydraulic fracturing, a demon, of course, that's probably always in the hydraulic fracturing, and the wise woman is probably nature too. Martyr, wise man, damsel in distress, and the fool are just another several of the archetypal narratives. Here's a photograph or a picture of Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. And I think if you look at it really closely, you'll see basically what's happening at a protest outside a company that's promoting hydraulic fracturing. Aha. A company that's trying to get leases or doing a lot of drilling and getting permits. Anyway, that's my little joke. But I would say that if you look closely at Hieronymus Bosch, you see archetypes run amok, perfect depictions of the archetypes. And if you are trying to counter the apocalyptic narrative or archetypal narratives, or you're trying to invoke them, it's very useful to look at Hieronymus Bosch and get those narratives and those narrative images going too. So let's look at legacy thinking. I'm talking now about how a lot of people have been trained to think of any kind of discourse that comes from an official source. And I'd like to talk about Michel Foucault's Discourse of Power, Knowledge, Discipline, and Punish. And essentially, a person who has been steeped in deconstructive philosophy and the ideas of Michel Foucault will suggest that the powers that be have invaded your mind and have basically established what is real and what is not real by power. If you counter the dominant beliefs, you will be punished. So in essence, after enough punishment, you self-censor so that you are going and espousing the party line. Now, so Michel Foucault says, what is real? What is real is often what the dominant ideology or dominant power tells you is real. May or may not really be real, but it's what tells you, they tell you it's real. In other words, it's socially constructed. And the question to ask behind that is, who decides? Who decides what's real? Who decides which version of reality we should adhere to? And once you answer that, then you unlock a lot of the ways to get at and start shattering some of the assumptions. So in today's world, the media would like you to think that the dominant powers, the companies are trying to tell you what is real, and they are deciding because they have money and power. I would like to say that, suggest that it may be the media and the attackers who are actually the ones with power, who are actually telling you what's real, regardless of if it really is essentially backed up by facts. And also, the media really has a lot more ability to enforce social norms, and informally and informally, using social networks, etc., or people use social media to enforce, whereas I'm not sure that the average government or company has the same amount of power, but I don't know. It's worth debating. But the key is to look at the underlying idea that anything that's real has been socially determined, and that it's perpetuated and propagated by today's social networks and a type of self-reinforcing discourse. And one thing that's a characteristic of this is that this is a post-Watergate world. Many of the people who are basically steeped in this kind of thinking are boomers and baby boomers. And that means that this is a very cynical, distrusting view of the world. And for that reason, it's very hard to make any positive progress, because any time that anybody says, wow, let's posit a different alternative reality, they'll say, okay, why? Okay, who bought you? You're bought and sold. Your facts are bought and sold. There's always an assumption that this is being enforced by power, and the powers by that be, and that the powers that be are the obvious, the usual suspects, and they're not the people who are actually questioning and saying those things. Anyway, so I think that it's very good to deconstruct the deconstructivists. Well, so let's go at and look at gamer thinking. Gamer thinking is not a cynical view of the world. Gamer thinking is one that is probably, if anything, filled with unrealized potential, because it's self-perpetuating and self-absorbed. It doesn't necessarily interact with things like fracking, because it's not interested in it. Because people who are the gamers, and the gamer thinking is all about some kind of emotional stimulus that creates extreme energy. A lot of people like to call it addiction. It's kind of a negative spin. We could call it hard work, work ethic. Anyway, Jane McGonigal, who is a programmer, and she's also a professor at Stanford, and she's a researcher, but she's a gamer, game programmer, game designer, has written a book, Reality is Broken. And she explains why the reality of the game is a lot more interesting than the reality that we currently live. And in answering a question, she asked, what are gamers good at? And one of the things they're good at is a sense of urgent optimism. Urgent optimism because they are on the verge of something big, and they believe that they can get it, that they have the ability, the agency, the power to get there. She also talks about weaving a tight social network and how gamers work with a team, maybe with avatars and identities that they've constructed, but it is a tight social network nonetheless. And they can spend hours and hours in blissful productivity focused on getting to the epic win. The urgent optimism comes because of their thinking that they are at the verge of a, quote, epic win. And so an epic win is something that's just groundbreaking, earth-shattering, it totally fills oneself, some one's world with meaning. In addition, in a gaming, the thing that's exciting is that it's meaningful, it's relevant, and there's all kinds of interaction, feedback. It's instant, it's useful. And she argues that if you could challenge and harness gamers to do some things that tie into the real world, then reality would no longer be broken. So imagine having gamers combing through the strata of the subsurface and going for discovering gold, discovering rare earths, discovering strategic minerals, or also figuring out where and how to best put hydraulic fracs, where the best and most brittle and ductile or brittle rocks are. And anyway, give gamers Poisson's ratio or Young's modulus. That would be exciting. Anyway, let's go to the next slide and look at Daniel Kahneman, who talked about heuristics and biases. Daniel Kahneman is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he received the Nobel Prize for all of his work in decision-making and biases and how people tend to blind themselves and why they do that. And he talked about two different parts of the brain. One part of the brain is the rules part of the brain, and the other part is the storytelling or the narrative part. And the interesting thing is that your decisions may be made by, boom, the rules area, or they may be made, boom, by the limbic system or the emotional part. But the narrative part of your brain is going to rationalize and describe and discuss and even seem to be engaged in a decision-making process, when in reality it isn't. The decision's already been done. The action's already been done. But you are deluding yourself that you have a choice, because you're busy constructing a narrative, but it's a narrative constructed about actions that are already done, predetermined, if you will, if you always have the same emotional reaction to something. So he came up with a number of ways to identify bias. He had listing a number of types of bias, and then he has a number of ways to de-bias your thinking. And usually what it has to do with is getting somebody who's an outsider in the outside world. The problem with bias is that it's usually reinforced by insiders. So you're not going to get any perspective whatsoever if you stick with your little clique. And, you know, teams are good, but get fresh perspectives. Mix it up a bit. Get different teams. So finally, let's look at the real world. And let's look at a case of a person who is caught in a narrative crossfire. In this case, this is Chip Grote, who is in Texas and associate director of the Energy Institute at the University of Texas. And his division, or his institute, just completed a 411-page report on hydraulic fracturing. And the conclusions were basically that hydraulic fracturing is not only benign, it's a positive thing. It's not necessarily bad for the earth, and that it can be safe. Well, that was met with a lot of enthusiasm by many people, and it was assumed to be completely unbiased and to be really solid, neutral academic work. Well, 2 weeks ago, unfortunately, Dr. Grote was questioned by a reporter who found that Chip Grote is on the board of directors of Plains Resources. And he's been on the board of directors for a number of years, and he's always revealed that and filed the appropriate paperwork. However, this year, I guess he got busy and didn't get around to it. And so he not only didn't disclose officially his potential conflict of interest, it was a very bad time for him to seem to be have a conflict of interest because Plains Resources does a significant amount of hydraulic fracturing, and in his capacity as director, he received $425,000. So supposedly his salary is very good at the University of Texas, $200,000 or something like that, but the $400,000 kind of dwarfs it. So what happened? He instantly became thrown into the maelstrom of competing narratives, and the teleological one about God, the puppet master. Who's the real puppet master? Well, I guess we don't know, but that's, we assume that he is, or maybe the company is the puppet master. Is he a sage and a truth teller? That archetype kicks in, but also so does trickster. Also, there is the assumption of hidden agendas. There's the deconstructive narrative kicking in. Crusader myths, those are kicking in from Jung and Campbell. There's those types of archetypal myths. Here's also a puppet versus or puppet master could be a conspiracy theory, and even if they find evidence that sort of refutes the idea of a grand conspiracy, it doesn't matter because conspiracy theories tend to have to cohere. So there he is in a coherence, in the general coherence type of narrative. Anyway, what this means is that with this sort of thing going on, there's infinite opportunity for dirty tricks and negative campaigning. If you think of Lee Atwater and also Karl Rove, behind the scenes political strategist, extremely effective. And one thing that we can just leave our